Welcome to the Business of Watches. This week, we have a special episode for our 30th episode. It is a Q&A episode, and that means we are going to take your questions that you've submitted to us on various channels. And I am fortunate enough to be joined by my esteemed colleagues, James Stacey, the editor-in-chief of Hodinkee. Welcome, James.
Hey, how's it going? Happy to be here. And congrats on 30.
We've come a long way.
We sure have.
Tantan Wang, editor at Hodinkee, joining us as well. Thank you, sir.
Hey, Andy. Good to see you.
Good to see you, sir. And Mark Kozlerich, senior editor at Hodinkee, who spent the weekend following the watch auctions. Welcome, Mark.
Yeah, thanks so much. Wish I was selling, and it would have been an extra great weekend.
Do you have any immediate sort of takeaways from that? You wrote a nice piece on that record journe. Where do you think we are in the auction market, Mark?
I think it's a really interesting time, especially considering that everybody that is selling knows everybody that's buying, and they're doing it publicly instead of amongst themselves, as some of them used to do more often. And I think they're just kind of feeding into each other's predilections a little bit, buying and selling the things that they know that they want, but doing so publicly drives the market for other things. And I'm just kind of curious to see where it goes, because I think you're starting to run out of the historically significant quote-unquote things from F.P. Journe. And so maybe things shift to brands like Kari Voutilainen, or even Debethune did quite well at Phillips over the weekend and surprised a lot of people. So we'll have to see where the market shifts, because I don't think that Journe can continue quite at the rate that it's been going.
Yeah, the Voutilainen results were quite unprecedented, yeah? I mean, what do you think there?
Yeah, I mean, all the watches that had Kari's name on it or had something to do with them went for over $1 million. My understanding, I might be wrong, so maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think that most of those watches came from a collector who is sort of prominent in the space, who passed away, and his family was taking care of deacquisitioning some of his watches, is my understanding, at least maybe for the Masterpiece Chronograph 2 is what it seemed to be online. But yeah, good timing. And I also know that I have a friend that put in an order for a Kari, and it's somewhere around a 7-year wait now. So there are going to be a number of people that have a lot of funds that don't want to wait and want to skip the line and maybe get something very significant. The other thing I'll call out too is the Marteau auction that's going on right now and will close soon. They have another unique Kari Voutilainen, and last I checked, the price was well over $1 million for this repeater that he did. So it's a good time to be a Kari seller, and good time to be Kari. And I guess same for Roger Smith. People are quite excited about his watches too.
Makes sense, right?
Yep. Yeah.
It's a very specific genre of watchmaking.
Absolutely. There's independence beyond François-Paul Journe. That's for sure. Okay, let's take our first question. It comes from Ninja Hamster. And Ninja Hamster asks, as 3D printing and modeling software improves, will we ever get to the point where movement manufacture is inexpensive enough to be democratized? So I guess this is a question of, you know, where are we in sort of 3D printing technology, and, you know, at what point will it become easier for one and all to make a watch movement, and will 3D printing have a role in that? When I think of 3D printing, I think of James Stacey, who is an enthusiast, certainly, in the 3D printing world. What do you think, James?
You know, I think there's a few different layers to this question. One, I would say we aren't at the tech scope of 3D printing, certainly not household 3D printing, where you could print a movement. You know, with Barrel Hand's most recent watch, you have the ability to print that watch, but it's, you know, it's like a blank that you could put a strap on and have an idea of its size and that sort of thing. And it's, you know, the idea is that it's part of a collection of CAD possibilities that could help them evolve the watch through the community of people who need or love the watch, or possibly both, depending on your ability to go to space in the future. I think more specifically, like the idea of movement manufacture being democratized, you know, you're talking about printing in metal, and you're still talking about the need to have a hairspring. You're still talking about the need to have a mainspring, things that at least right now are not really within the scope of printing. Granted, we are still in the first generation of household printing, maybe 1.5 generations, if you will. So I do think that this is something where in the future, a movement could be printed. Conceivably, it could be printed in place and have one or two pieces added to it. We aren't there in anything other than theoretical sort of 3D printing. And then in terms of democratized, I don't know how cheap the movement would need to be considered for it to be democratized, because a modern inexpensive, you know, even entry level, whether it's a Miyota 8215 or something from Salita, these are not movements that by bulk numbers cost much money. So I don't know where that number would need to be where you went, this is so cheap, I could buy a machine and print a movement at home. And then lastly, and I don't want to be unfair to Ninja Hamster because this is a fun question from a guy with a fun name, I don't know that anybody wants to print a movement at home. Watch brands would want to print a movement. And I would argue, having seen, you know, the processes at like EMP in Switzerland, they kind of are printing a movement or milling a movement in various stages. But even a movement, very, very little of that it comes from one place, right? The rubies have to come from somewhere, even if you're getting to that point.
Sure.
And then the last thing I would say, and Mark and Tantan, you should step all over me if you think I'm getting wrong on this, but like, even if you could print the various elements, the main plates, a rotor, gearing, things like that, even if you could print those to the exceptional tolerances that even a standardized mechanical movement would require, I don't know that the bulk of the work is actually creating the part as much as it is putting everything together in a way that can keep time. Is that unfair, loosely fair, partway there?
No, I think that's pretty spot on. I think from the sort of democratization standpoint, I am sort of interpreting this question more of like, oh, can any micro, are we just going to basically see a lot of micro brands with their own in-house calibers, you know, 15 yeah. years down the line? And I think I'm on the same page here, where I agree where I think by the nature of what defines the appeal of these brands, I think it's not necessarily necessary, or there isn't that current appeal. You know, I just came back from visiting Casio in Japan, where you're seeing minuscule gears being injection molded to a scale where I actually didn't realize you could injection mold at. But, you know, that is a way of making extremely inexpensive parts. But the thing is, the cost is all in creating that injection mold, right? Which could, you know, could be $250,000 each, you know, as speculation. So long story short, I agree here where, you know, additive manufacturing right now, at least in the watch space, is so much around exploring what can't be done. I think from, you know, mostly right now from an aesthetic point of view, you obviously have exceptions where, you know, Ming's polymesh bracelet is something that is not only an aesthetic.
Apple Watch Ultra.
Yeah, it's super, super interesting and just there's nothing like it. But right now, I think it is exploring things where you can't, you know, creating things that you can't just CNC or injection mold, especially structurally.
Yep.
So long story short, maybe we'll see this change in many years. But, you know, to me, injection molding and, you know, metal injection molding is getting to be a process that more and more brands are using to create parts. I think we're going to see more of that and not necessarily sort of 3D printing as a technique.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things you have to keep in mind is, as much as we'd like to see massive leaps and bounds and improvement and the underlying part of the democratization thing, I think it has something to do with the fact that people just would like watches to be more affordable in general. And I think there are affordable options, but yeah, it would be great if everything, if Pateks were more affordable because they had, you know, solved some sort of the process. But I hate to say it, I know there's things that will be improved in the next 10-20 years, but I think there's a big part of this that's like a lot of watchmaking is a sort of a solved thing already. You know, the ideal gear ratios for things for a three-hand watch and chronographs are really hard to design because the best chronograph designs have largely been done already. And so where do you shave off a little bit of a margin to give people a more democratically accessible watch? I don't know that it's 3D printing, and I don't know that's where the bulk of the cost, like James said, comes from. I think it's other parts of the process.
Because I guess in some ways, the closest we as a species have come to this would be the System 51.
Yeah.
Swatch.
Mm-hmm. You know, in that it's not additively produced, but it is built with no human interaction. Which I guess at least puts it in the same genre as something that's kind of in a way it's printed in place. It's not, of course, but like it comes together in that sort of without a human assembly. But yeah, I don't know how many generations away we could be, and you know, nobody really has a scope on like what real qualified next generation AI could do to 3D printing.
Yeah.
And the understandings of these things. So I would say it's possible that it's not here yet. And I don't know necessarily what the market would be for hobbyists. Amazing, right? When they eventually get to the point where you could download a file to print, and they are to a certain extent here, but like massively print a metal part for, say, a vehicle that you were servicing, that will be a big sort of leap forward in the consumer side of this. You could go to your auto parts store and they would print the piece that you wanted rather than having it shipped around and all that kind of thing. Who knows? But yeah, maybe there is a world in which that's something that outcomes. My guess is that we'll see more and more brands go down the same route as Gerard Perregaux and Tag Heuer and consistently develop structures within movements that use specific materials for their purpose.
Hmm.
And the more materials you put into a tiny thing, the less likely it will 3D print really well, right? As you'd be switching mediums throughout. But there's a world in which base plates, sure, why not? Right? Rotors. Yep. Maybe even gears.
Yeah.
Don't see why not. If you've held the Ming bracelet, wouldn't surprise me if you could 3D sinter titanium gearing. So yeah,
for sure. But it is important to note that, especially when we're talking about the micro brands, indeed that access to the movement at wholesale costs is really not your biggest cost center there. And if there's an issue for the micro brands, it's having access to those things at the smaller scale.
Yeah, where the minimum orders might be too big.
Exactly.
And then for those who are bored, go on Perrin, go on Esslinger and see what a movement costs if you buy one.
Yeah.
There's just some of them aren't that much. You know, the movement in that DWC Terra I spoke about and have written about, if you had to replace just one of them, it was like $8.
Yeah, exactly. So.
If you're making 5,000 of those, it's not going to be $8 a movement, right? So,
indeed.
Cool question.
All right, let's move on to our next question. This is from Kyle Sin DC, and they ask, are brands trying to keep up with the breakneck pace of new releases demanded by enthusiasts and social media, or are they still keeping to their own release schedule and hoping things level off? How much weight do brands give enthusiasts when making design and release choices?
I can jump in. I think one of the things that I try to keep in mind too, and I encourage people when they're reading about watches online or thinking about watches or thinking about the things that they wish that were being launched is like, some brands have and even will admit that they sort of overdid it in terms of release schedules and things. I think Grand Seiko has really tried to pare back their releases just generally in terms of number, but also the pace that they're doing it at. But then you compare it to something like Citizen. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that Citizen makes that we just don't cover. There's things that are more for a broader commercial audience. I mean, there's been collaborations with cartoon characters and stuff that, like, we all love Peanuts, and we've seen them on in a variety of, you know, Snoopy watches and stuff like that. But an anime watch or something like that, that is not going to be something that we cover. And so what we're seeing is two things. One, we're only seeing a portion of the world of what releases are. And two, we're also only a fraction of the market. And so it's hard for me sometimes when I look at release schedules or what's being released or the decisions of exactly how they're making and what they're making. Like this, we're not necessarily always the people that are being spoken to.
Yeah.
So how they choose to release things and what timeline, how frequent, how close to Watches and Wonders or after, it's hard to say if they're doing it right or wrong. Sometimes it's overwhelming for us, but it's hard to say that they're doing it wrong. It might work perfectly for them.
Yeah. I think sometimes people forget the sheer scale that many of these brands demand. You know, when we talk about a lot of the brands that, you know, have releases that debut at Watches and Wonders, we're talking production, you know, for the horology, it's like, you know, 60,000 pieces a year or something like that. But for, you know, the mass market brands, we're talking like Citizen, Timex. I think, yes, we as enthusiasts love to talk about this stuff, but sometimes I think we also forget that, you know, these brands have such a huge customer base in, for example, department stores, right? So their release cycles are often actually around a fashion calendar, right? That was something when I was a buyer, like something that we had to actually deal with. And it was a challenge because we think about shaping launches around moments, right? Okay, like this is going to be a big thing. Let's tell a story about that. But, you know, Timex, at the scale that they need to produce things, just have spring, summer, and they launch everything at once, right? So right. I think we forget sometimes how big this customer base is. And, you know, again, the thing I always like to remind people is, you know, while a lot of enthusiast brands that we talk about, yes, you have to think about enthusiasts when making design and release choices. But my favorite example is, you know, what we actually kind of struggled with selling is actually watches without a date window. Mm. I think that's like the biggest thing in my mind that, you know, shows sort of this kind of cognitive dissonance where anytime you would ask people why they were not buying new releases, it's they were like, there's no date window. You know, it's something that, you know, I just need a date window on my watch. And so, and, you know, oftentimes you would hear, oh, this is actually too small.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, again, it's realizing that, like, you know, I speak on behalf of the watch nerds where oftentimes there's a very, you know, homogenous point of view. But again, we are, you know, we are not one hive mind and there's so many points of view to consider. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, the point of view that wins, it's the one that sells the most watches, right? And that's not always the enthusiasts.
And if I can just jump back in real quick on the date window thing, because this is one of my favorite examples to pull out, and it shows that like what enthusiasts want, whether it's in the product or the product release schedule or whatever. I went to a couple of years ago, the relaunch of the Breguet Type 20, and we saw what was coming, and I knew that it was going to be two watches with the date window, and they previously had one with and one without. And all I could think is, you know, why do they do it this way again? And I talked to somebody who is a retailer who sells a lot of Breguet. And then I also talked to the team at Breguet, but the retailer said, nobody at that price point is walking in off the street and going to buy a watch without a date window, never having considered this watch before. But there are people with $25,000 to spend that will walk in off the street, fall in love with a watch that they didn't expect to look at, and just snap by a watch. And the date window is a make or break thing. People are just not going to buy that watch without a date window. And I think it's like, okay, an enthusiast would say, no, you're completely wrong. But how many of the people that are buying are actually enthusiasts? So,
yeah. Yeah. James, any thoughts?
Yeah, just on the first part, I would just say, you know, with the breakneck pace, I think we're seeing a little bit of whiplash from a scenario of spending that just disappeared in the last couple of years. What came up in the 2021-22 range, we saw it in cars, you saw it in art, you saw it in collectibles of all sorts. And a lot of those markets remain elevated to some extent, especially in the consumer mind or in the enthusiast mind. But like a lot of these brands, I think they suddenly saw a windfall. And, you know, it does take some time to spin up another watch. Even if you're a small brand, it might take months. And if you're a big brand and you have a lot more checks and balances and a longer product cycle, I think we might still be seeing a speed that references a market that's kind of dried in some respects or reshaped itself back to reality over the last few years. Again, speaking more into the enthusiast space. The generalist space, I think there's, you just make, if you're a big brand, you make a lot of SKUs. And that's why, you know, you'll see enthusiasts go, oh, why would they make this watch at 45 millimeters? It should be 40. And you go, well, they're making them at 45 because they're selling them.
Yep.
Right. And even a really big brand, you might have a stinker or like something that doesn't sell that well, but you wouldn't keep doing it. Right. These are, you know, the goal of the brand would be to make money. So that's the only thing that would kind of hit me is I think that the pace has been largely high. And because there was this big spike in attention and spending a few years ago. And I think we're still seeing the kind of knock-on effect from that from a product standpoint where we people with credit cards and time to read about watches and that sort of thing can react quite quickly in and out of a buying mood. The product can take some time to reflect that.
Andy, I'm curious to hear kind of your thoughts on this because from my perspective, I see a lot of this sort of continuing of the sort of rate that James is mentioning, as also a result that a lot of the brands that we're thinking of are, you know, part of conglomerates that are publicly traded. And, you know, when things come to be publicly traded,
you
can't go down, right? You can it only goes up, right? That's how we think. So I'm curious.
You have to show some growth.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, the quest of infinite growth from anything that's publicly traded at this point. Andy, I'm curious if you agree or disagree that that's something that we're seeing or you know, at least somewhat a cause.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of fits into some of the questions we've already had, and that there is this you know, difference between, you know, the true enthusiast market and the mass market. And, you know, the mass market is sometimes looking for something new. Like, I mean, like we said, you know, if you put the right cartoon character on a watch, for some people, they need to buy that watch, and it's because of their affinity for that character or that idea, as opposed to the watch itself. And you know, I think the watch industry, as it is structured at the moment, can't exist solely on the enthusiast community, and it can't cater simply to the enthusiast community. Although there is no doubt that, you know, the enthusiast community, the education and the understanding of watches has certainly, you know, improved, gotten larger, yeah. All those things. But indeed, you know, it is difficult for a publicly traded company to say, look, you know, we decided to cut production and just, you know, cut the number of SKUs we're doing here. And we're just, in order to sort of, you know, meet where we are in the market. And remember, yeah, these are industrial processes. They take time, et cetera. But at the same time, you know, what the move has been to, you know, slowly reduce production and increase prices. And obviously, you know, inflation in terms of input costs here in Switzerland is a real thing. Labor is among the most expensive in the world. Obviously, we've seen the Swiss franc continue to appreciate against the US dollar and other currencies. So that, you know, makes watches more expensive. And indeed, you know, that gets us to this concern that many have, that watches have sort of priced themselves out of the market for a certain segment of the market. Mm-hmm. But indeed, it's very difficult for these established, larger size, you know, what we'd call volume brands to pare things back when at the end of the day, they have to answer to shareholders. And that means, you know, increasing sales. And there's only a few ways to do that.
It's also the scenario that if you combine the internet and digital photography and the growth of hobbyist and enthusiast press is what created the micro brands in the indies, right? Is this sort of disconnection between mass market brands and their most ardent collectors or the most ardent interested parties, collectors or otherwise, you know, and the niche became, for some people, an $800 dive watch that was the right size with the right movement and bought from a guy whose first name you knew and you could probably see him in a local city, all the way up to kind of the same idea, but a Jorn, a Kari, you know, taking us back to what Mark was talking about earlier. Everything's kind of a response to something else. Like every genre of music feeds off of the one that was popular before it, and it kind of works that way in watches as well. So good question, though. Fun one.
The last thing I'll say about this too is there's two analogies you could think of. It's first, like you're moving an oil tanker in the sea. It's going to take a long time to change course with some of these brands. And so the nice thing about an indie or a Jorn, who until this year I think made one new movement design for every year for the last 20 plus years, you can just adapt. If something's not working or your clients want something, you can adapt more quickly. And the other analogy too is what you're looking at is it's kind of like trying to pull a tractor trailer using a rubber band. Is if you lay on the brakes real hard because you see that the market is shifting, well, the trailer behind you is not going to stop because it's gonna rebound and it's gonna take a while to catch up to whatever your plan is. And so if you feel like things aren't right, whether it's release schedules or prices or whatever, I think you're going to see some changes have to occur. It's just that they might be slower the larger the brand is.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember Cyril Vigneron, when he was the CEO of Cartier, espousing the brand's ability to be able to adjust production for models that were more popular than others, saying that this is a unique or new attribute that they developed in their production process, and that the, you know, this was a good thing. Cartier, part of Richemont, the biggest selling brand, watch brand at Richemont, a publicly traded company. So our next question, we'll move on, is from Bobby G. And they ask, where do you see the trend going in monobrand boutiques versus multi-brand boutiques? Do we think it will be a K-shaped approach? So K-shaped meaning one end going up, the other end going down, high end wanting to control the narrative, and the lower end needing to be in as many spaces as possible to generate sales. You know, it is this, you know, continuous, interesting sort of element of the watch industry as opposed to many others, and that, you know, in boutiques, in-person experiences are still pretty critical for selling watches. What do we think?
This seems to go hand in hand with the previous question in a way, is certain brands are going to want more control over these things so they can adapt more quickly. And you see, I won't say who because it was more on background, but I spoke to a brand that's, you know, adjusted the number of boutiques that they've had in the United States overall and had some shifts in leadership. And one of the things that they were very cognizant of is saying to their boutiques, no, we're not going to give you more of certain watches until you sell through what you've been sitting on. And it allows them to sort of motivate their own sales staff to make sure that watches aren't sitting around a long time to the advantage of other models. So I think, like, yeah, at a very high end, that makes sense. Now, of course, then that ends up being frustrating to the buyers at the high end because they walk into a boutique and say, I want X model, and it's the hot model, and then they can't get it. And I mean, there's a lot of factors at play in that, but I think you're seeing it more on the high end, and I don't think we're gonna lose that because it is such a beneficial tool for them, and at the same time, unfortunately, a frustrating thing for the clients.
Yeah, I mean, even at a point where we're seeing sort of reactionary sort of decrease in spending across the board, when we're talking about a lot of these ultra high end monobrand boutiques, they are still very much weathering the storm, so to speak, and you know, a lot of these brands just don't produce enough, right? They don't produce enough out of, you know, necessity, but also, you know, just, you know, for example, Lange is a great example where they made a huge move to kind of move to corporate-only boutiques. And of course, there are exceptions these days, right? There are still some partner boutiques with retailers across the board and around the world. But, you know, when you make 5,500 watches, You didn't have enough to begin with, at least from what we're seeing. And so, you know, when you actually can control the sort of customer base in this way, I think a lot of times it is also good for it's actually kind of hard to say, right? Like on one hand, it's great. I think it's better for clients because if you do actually establish a relationship with a brand, I think it rewards you down the line. But at the same time, that also means that a lot of people, you know, have single-handedly complained, oh, when things move from mono, from multi-brand boutiques to mono, you just lose everything. You lose all your history. You lose everything that you did, especially when brands weren't as popular, right? So in effect, you're losing the early adopters and brands are actually pushing them out of the way in sort of replacement for new blood. But again, when you go to a monobrand boutique, I don't know, it's kind of hard to imagine you ever going back, right? Like, I don't think there's a precedent to, you know, brands being like, oops, I guess this doesn't work. Let's go back to sort of multi-brand retailers in a way, or, you know, well, is there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, Lange is certainly, that's been the move, and AP, Audemars Piguet has done the same thing. But I think, you know, we're starting to see, as the market, you know, turns a bit, it's a bit harder even for these brands to sell watches. We are seeing just the pendulum swing back a little bit in terms of brands being more open to being in multi-brand boutiques. And, you know, these brands, even if you're Lange, even if you're Audemars Piguet, you do have to get in front of new customers in one way or the other. And, you know, we've seen consolidation happening on the multi-brand side, obviously, in certain markets. So there are, you know, less players in that space. Watches of Switzerland, the owner, parent company of Hodiki, certainly being one of them in the U.S. But I think, you know, for brands that can afford to do it, it obviously makes sense. They get to know their customer better. They can control and have oversight over things much better. But, you know, look, the biggest of them all, Rolex, you know, continues, even though they own Boucher and Tourneau now. But, I mean, they continue to work with primarily outside retailers. James, did you have any thoughts on the retail side?
I mean, I think you guys really covered it here. The only thing that hits me is you know, I have a big fondness for brands that are internet born and raised, that sell online. And the thing that has changed since the early days of PRS Dreadnoughts and like, you know, Ocean Sevens and Bernhardts and that sort of stuff is the show circuit that is available to a one-man brand. The Windups, the Toronto System, Intersect. You know, at this point, if we listed the shows, we would actually run out of time. There's so many. And I have very frequent conversations because this is a part of the world I still, the watch world I really love, you know, sub $5,000 watches made by two or three people who are good at CAD and have done the work to put all their suppliers together. And the challenge is there is always which one do I go to, right? Because you want to be able to sell online, and if you're successful, your watches will sell. But the human element that pendulum seems to have swung where maybe when I was first, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008 on WatchYouSeek, and you go like the point of it was, I bought this from this guy, Mitch, in Florida. Shout out Ocean 7, right? And I didn't have to meet Mitch. I didn't have to go into a store. I don't want to be unfair, so I won't name the brand necessarily, but, you know, there were even very early micro brands that made the leap to retail, and it wiped out their business because those DTC margins didn't exist when they had to share with a store. And now you kind of give the shows the option where a brand can show up to one or two of these shows a year or maybe more in their market. Not British Watchmakers Day seems to be a great example of let's get as many of these guys in a room to sit with the people who actually are on their websites all the time. And, you know, we had Richard on from Studio Underdog just recently, great example of a guy who's really figured out that mix of real world presence and the ability to sell easily and simply and quickly and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's the ancillary orbiting element around those two options of multi-brand stores or singular stores are, you know, the goal being somebody comes in and has your watch on their wrist. And I think the show circuits have become a really important part of that for probably brands up to what I guess Oris maybe. That sort of thing.
Yeah. And the other thing that I don't want to discount the frustration that people have, especially, I mean, getting the watches you want is for a lot of these brands is going to be hard either way. And I don't want to discount that. I also don't want to discount the idea that, you know, spend history at some of these boutiques going out the window, you know, for some of these places that have moved completely boutique only instead of ADs, like they don't care that unless you spent the money through them, it doesn't really count, which is frustrating. But the main frustration that I think I hear from a lot of people too is if you live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and you want to get an AP, you know, and or you want to get a Patek. I mean, Patek, for instance, pulled their at one time, Rumley's Jewelers in Green Bay, Wisconsin, was their oldest independent retailer in the world, and they retailed basically only Rolex, Patek, Tag Heuer, Cartier, and Tudor. And Patek pulled out. Well, what happens if you're living in Green Bay, Milwaukee, Wausau, one of these places that you maybe do have a long history with Patek, but now it's gone? So I think that is to me the biggest tragedy for a lot of people that really care about stuff and have long histories, is that you lose that and you lose access to be able to walk in and try something on. It's a bummer, but unfortunately that's the way that it's going. And you see, especially at these high net worth individuals, it unfortunately is probably easier for them to travel than most people, so they can go to New York and try something on at a longer boutique.
No, that makes total sense. Yeah, I mean, it works at the high end and, you know, to exclude those less concentrated, those urban areas that can still work with the business model. But indeed, in more rural places, it makes it very difficult to see those watches in person. Well, look, gentlemen, it's been almost 40 minutes. And so thank you for joining us. Excellent to have your insights on these sort of business-related questions on the business of watches. And we appreciate it, and we'll speak to you soon.
Absolutely. Let's do another one at 40. We can even save some of these questions, or we can do it again. We grabbed them off of Instagram and a couple other spots, but this was fun. Thanks for the including.
# road to 40.
Thought it'll be here in no time. It'll still be warm outside.
And that's the business of watches for this episode. We hope you enjoyed. Please head on over to hodinkee.com where you can join the discussion and leave any comments or questions about this episode or the business of watches in general. Who knows, we might even answer your question on a future episode. Thanks for listening and see you next time.